Welcome to Radio Times. I'm Tracy Matisak, in for Marty Moscowain. In challenging times, what is it that separates the strong leaders from the weak? Why do some leaders make prudent decisions and others make disastrous ones? A quick glance at the headlines is about all it takes to see why leaders matter and how their words and actions can make or break the organizations they lead. With so many recent shakeups in the corporate world, in higher education and other areas, there's been lots of talk about leadership and how to do it well. So this hour, we're talking with an expert on the subject, one who has taken the characteristics of great leaders and created a checklist to help others get and stay on top of their game. Michael Youssim is management professor and director of the Center for Leadership and Change Management at the Wharton School of the University of Pennsylvania. He consults with organizations around the world and has written a number of books on the subject. His most recent is The Leader's Checklist. It's a collection of guiding principles for leading well in an uncertain world. Michael, welcome to Radio Times.
Tracy, good to be here.
So why do leaders need a checklist?
Well, they need a checklist a little bit like a pilot is well served by a pre-flight checklist that includes such things as weather and fuel. And by the same kind of argument, surgeons as well need a preoperative checklist, that includes such items as, do I have the right patient? And is it the left side and the right side that I'm about to create an incision in? For over 80 years now, the Federal Aviation Authority and the military equivalents have required all pilots of a Boeing 737, an F-18 on an aircraft carrier, to go through that pre-flight checklist for the obvious reason: if you miss anything on that checklist, you've got a problem. Yeah. Weight, fuel, anti-collision radar, and so on. Same thing for the surgeon. To commence surgery on the wrong patient obviously is a little bit of a problem. And so many hospitals around the world have begun to adopt a pre-surgical checklist as well. By the same line of argument, leaders, I think, can better serve themselves and ultimately the people that they're serving if they're very clear-minded about the 10 to 15 critical, call them critical principles, that they need to incorporate into whatever they do. Speaking at an offsite, writing a memo, making a decision, going into a boardroom, sitting down with three employees, very good to remind yourself before each of those moments, just like you're about to take off with an aircraft. If you're a pilot, you're about to commence surgery. If you're a surgeon, good to remind yourselves that during that dialogue, during that engagement, during that leadership moment with the people around you, you do incorporate these 10 to 15 principles.
And, you know, we can understand it for a surgeon. We can understand it for a pilot. I don't think that we've, as a society, have thought so much about the tremendous power that leaders wield in other arenas until we see the disastrous consequences when perhaps they don't.
Yeah, I think we do appreciate leadership when it's missing for the impact that it has more clearly than almost any other moment. So think about the BP disaster in the Gulf. Mm-hmm. Think about the shortcomings that led to the enormous problems in New Orleans after Katrina. Think about what happened at Penn State. But the flip side of that is it's very good to remind yourself also about the affirmative impact of great leadership. And we know that when we see it, at least in more general terms, if you think about Nelson Mandela, Martin Luther King, Eleanor Roosevelt, Mother Teresa, George C. Marshall, our World War II top uniformed officer, we know that they made an enormous affirmative impact on their world. And so good to remind ourselves that the lack of leadership can be catastrophic, but great leadership can get us to a more promised land.
Indeed. Well, what was it that inspired you to create this list?
For me personally, two considerations led to this framing around the leader's checklist. Number one, here in working with many organizations, we work with MBA students, undergraduate, executive MBA students, mid-career people, and many off-campus organizations ranging from the United Nations to Citi, the big New York-based bank. And in hearing, especially from mid-level people, about what they wish they saw more of in those who lead them, I'm always struck by the fact that what can seem blindingly obvious to an outsider or to a follower was not so obvious to the leader when they came on stage and forgot, in effect, to check the fuel.
Wow.
So, for instance, I often hear that as an individual who's in a leadership position appears in public, an off-site or even just a small conference room, that they don't say a whole lot about where the organization is going. Call that the vision thing. They don't reference a whole lot about the strategy for getting there. They don't make really any reference on as to how they're going to do it. So to turn that around, I think, as I hear from people in the front line and mid-career ranks, what they most want to see in the leaders that lead them, it led to this set of, I've come up with 15 principles that constitute for me a kind of a checklist. The second source, though, of inspiration on this, if you will, is the writings of Atul Gawande. Many people will know that name from The New Yorker, where he's a part-time writer, not a full-time staff writer. Atul Gawande is a surgeon in Boston at Brigham and Women's Hospital. And in the pages of The New Yorker, and then in a book with the title The Checklist Manifesto, he pretty compellingly argues that for surgeons and for just about everybody, having a bit of a mental checklist to go through what you need to do before you get out there in a leadership position is going to be a really good thing.
Yeah. So let's talk about some of those principles. There are 15 of them, as you mentioned, and perhaps more depending on your line of work or who you lead and that sort of thing. But let's unpack a couple of those principles, some of the essentials that leaders need to make sure that they've got on their agenda.
Tracy, I'm going to pick out three, top of the list, mid part, and then number 15. At the top of the list, I've already referenced the vital importance of anybody in a leadership position. Think the head of WHYY, think the mayor of Philadelphia, think the president of the country, think the chief executive of DuPont, to be completely clear-minded and articulate in expressing where the organization is going, how it's going to get there, and what it will take day-to-day to make that happen. So top line is you have to have a vision, you need a strategy to ultimately get anywhere, and you have to be able to execute. That's a business phrase that's become more widely known, execution, just making things happen. If you've got a great vision and a great strategy and you can't execute, actually make it happen, you are indeed not going to get to where you want to get to. In the middle of the list, I think I would single out decisive decision-making. You really have to be able to reach good and timely decisions in a leadership position. Everybody I've ever spoken with about this topic remembers a boss that just allowed stuff to pile up on his or her desk. Put that differently, we've done a lot of work with the U.S. Marine Corps, and one of the mantras that is offered at the Marine Corps' Officer Candidate School, Quantico, Virginia, is if you can't make a decision as a future officer of the U.S. Marine Corps, you have chosen the wrong pursuit.
Yeah. You don't even need to be here.
Yeah, right? You don't need to be here. In fact, you won't be here because the Officer Candidate School not only trains, but it also selects future officers. At the end of the list, and in some respects, almost a defining element of what leadership is to remind yourself that in your leadership position, it's not about managing your career. It's not about accumulating anything that would benefit you. All that's important. Everybody has to manage their career. I teach that as one of the topics in our management courses in our MBA program as one theme. But having said that, call it selfless leadership, call it mission first, self-interest last.
Like a servant leadership?
Servant leadership is a phrase. I've always loved the way it was put during the U.S. Civil War by Civil War cavalry commanders. They had a dictum that really made the point extremely well. If you're a cavalry commander, feed your horses, feed your soldiers, then feed yourself.
You before me.
Exactly.
Idea. Yeah.
That is a summary.
Yeah. So much to talk about. And when we think about leaders today, often having to make decisions on the fly, often having to make big decisions in the midst of a lot of uncertainty where it's really not clear where the consequences are going to lead. It just places so much more pressure, plus all the scrutiny on our leaders. The fact that because of technology, you know, things can go viral really quickly. And I would think that that even adds to the pressure on a leader and all the more reason to kind of have something to sort of look through before you make a decision.
You know, it's almost a perfect summary of the academic research evidence on when leadership makes greatest difference. Leadership, of course, makes a difference, and under most circumstances, we know that's true, but its greatest impact comes when an organization, a company, a foundation, a hospital, a university, a nation is looking at uncertain and changing times. When life is less uncertain, less changing, the decisions of the people at the top, less consequential. Yeah. To turn that around then, I think everybody I've ever spoken with, my guess is your listeners are probably nodding their head on this one, would say as we look at the next 4 or 5 years, the future is always a little bit more uncertain than the past. We know that. But having said that, markets, the economy, the uncertainty politically in the U.S. and abroad, the changing nature of technologies in many industries, think telecommunication, for example, is leading to more uncertainty and more rapid change. Thus, more important now than at some point in the past to get the leadership formula right. And what's the formula? There are many great formulas out there. Steve Covey wrote a great book, Seven Habits, that has seven great principles yeah. there. Jim Collins has written a couple books that puts forward principles, and drawing on all of those and a good bit of academic research, it's always, in the last couple of years really working this through, seemed to me that 10 or 15 principles really constitute the formula. That does raise, and I'll stop on this, the issue of how you get that. Nobody is born with leadership as part of their DNA, even though we have a phrase, somebody is a natural-born yeah. leader. But most people just are not natural born. So a question we could come back to is, how do you get it if you don't
have it? And your premise is that leadership can, in fact, be learned.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Well, we want to talk about that and so much more. There has been so much going on in the news. We want to talk about that. I want to talk a little bit about Stephen Covey and his legacy. He recently passed away, and many people remember his book, The Seven Habits of Highly Effective People, and some of his work after that. We want to talk about the importance of ethics and integrity in leadership, and perhaps even what's going on in MBA classrooms these days around that. So much more to talk about. We'd love to have your input as well. If you've got questions or comments for Michael Youssim on the subject of leadership that is becoming more and more critical, it would seem, every day. That's what we're talking about on Radio Times, and we'll be back right after this.
Penn supports WHYY. Do you frequently walk into a room and immediately forget why? Do you need to write things down to remember them? Is multitasking getting harder? If so, you may qualify for a research study focusing on memory in menopausal women. The Penn Center for Women's Behavioral Wellness is seeking women between the ages of 45 and 60 and within 5 years of their last menstrual cycle to participate in research to study the effects of certain hormones and medication on cognition in peri- and postmenopausal women. 215-41-STUDY.
Teachers from grades 7 through 12 can take their classroom skills to the next digital level. WHYY, through American Graduate, is now offering scholarships for teachers to attend a special course, Visual Storytelling Basics for the Classroom, at WHYY's Hamilton Commons. Learn firsthand how smartphones, still cameras, and simple free editing software can enhance your classroom and encourage students. Classes are November 3rd. Apply for your full scholarship now at whyy.org/American Graduate.
In the wake of last week's deadly shooting in a Colorado movie theater, we've been talking about mental health and about our nation's gun laws. Now we'll ask our panel of women commentators to weigh in from their diverse perspectives. That's next time on Tell Me More.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
Welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Tracy Matisak, filling in for Marty Moskowain, and we are talking about leadership and what happens when it's done well and what the consequences are when it's not done so well. Certainly there have been examples of both in the headlines lately, and for some help around that issue, we are talking with Michael Youssim. He's the author of The Leader's Checklist, and he also happens to be a management professor and director of the Center for Leadership and Change Management at the Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania. Mike, when we left off, we were talking about, are leaders born or made? And there certainly has been some debate around that issue, but you're pretty firm on leadership can be learned.
You know, to offer an example of, in a sense, the opposite point, just to anchor that, several of the colleagues, student friends of a Yale undergraduate, when this Yale undergraduate many years ago was around age 19 or 20, said to themselves, this person is going to go on and do something amazing in life. He seemed a natural. The person in question here is named Fred Smith, who founded FedEx and runs it many, many years later, still as chief executive. And he might have been in that category that I think we all have a few examples in our own, the back of our head here, of somebody who's just a natural born leader. Fifth grade, they were president of the class. Every sports team they were on, they were elected captain.
They're the captain,
yeah,
right?
They had a head start. Having said that, for most people, it's a unnatural skill set. And if you just think about yourself at age 15, and if you're now in a position of having responsibility for anybody else, and just about everybody does carry some responsibility like that, you've learned across the years what it does take to make a difference in a good sense in the lives of other people. With that as a premise, a conclusion really, with lots of research to back that one up, at the school where I do teach, we have incoming in the fall, just a few weeks away now, over 1,000 MBA and executive MBA students. We will have another 550 incoming undergraduates. And for those new, fresh people, age 18 as they arrive, we require a leadership course. For those MBA students, average age 28. For executive MBA students, average age 34 or 35. There, too, we require a course on leadership. Underlying notion, of course, is that some people are already more able, more gifted, more experienced. We have people coming back into our program, for example, who run divisions of companies, have led 150 soldiers in combat in Iraq, and they, in that sense, have a good bit more experience under their belt. Having said that, we do believe if you go from where you are now, take what you are given or maybe have learned along the way, you can unequivocally strengthen that, extend it, and build on it.
I want to invite our listeners to join in our conversation. We're talking about leadership, specifically about a book called The Leader's Checklist, to help leaders make good decisions in uncertain circumstances like so many that we see in our day and age. The number is 888-477-9499 if you would like to join in our conversation. So much here, Mike. I want to talk to you about how you teach executives about leadership, and you take them to some pretty interesting places in order to do that.
Yeah, Tracy, we pick up on a kind of a threefold path for leadership development. Number one, we believe that in the first instance, people can become a self-directed, lifelong student of leadership. And what that signifies is pretty obvious, is look around you. You work with people, some great, some terrible. Learn from them all. Pick up books by Warren Bennis or Steve Covey or Jim Collins and see what they have to say. Draw upon that. Basic notion, serving as a self-directed, lifelong student of leadership. Number two, we believe that the power of mentoring or coaching cannot be overstated. And what does that entail? Typically finding somebody, a high school teacher, a sports coach, a person that you work with, who's willing to give you offline, fine-grained feedback on what you do well and where you can further strengthen. Number three, most vital, the research makes pretty clear, is given the first two, then get out there and do it. Get into the game. Take on responsibility. Put your hand up and do what you haven't done before. And thus learning by doing, picking up feedback, doing what the armed forces will call the after-action review, is part of a bigger formula. So self-directed study of leadership, finding coaches and mentors, and number three, most importantly, taking what you've done with the first two and then testing yourself. And for that reason, at the school, and many institutions do this now, we have for more than a decade taken large numbers of students and mid-career managers to the Gettysburg Battlefield or the Antietam Civil War Battlefield. We take a group every year to Antarctica. I, in a more individual way, take a number of people out to the base camp area of Mount Everest. We've worked with the Marine Corps. We bring in a Shakespeare group. All of these endeavors intended to take people with some of the ideas that they've thought about, read about in Steve Covey or elsewhere, to take what coaches or mentors have been saying, look, you've got to work on this, and then get out there and do that. Read the context, recognize your mistakes, and get better for it.
Talk about getting out of your comfort zone.
This is way out of your comfort zone. I've been with our Antarctica group about a three-hour flight from the tip of Chile down to the Antarctica Peninsula where we spend a week. And the first thing we notice is it's really cold. And then it was pretty much a week of survival against the odds. But having gone through that, I learned a lot myself. I think, for instance, with that, I knew ahead of time, you've got to be very tough-minded when times are hard. In this case, extremely cold, and we were wet and pretty soggy the whole time with a week being in the outdoors of the Antarctic. We were camped out. And with that, I knew that was an important principle, which is take it, be tough, get beyond the problems, talk about the solutions. But having gone through that and putting that to the test, I'd like to think I was better for it. I'm still working on that one. I'd like to think our students were better for it, too.
What are the observations that you come away with after you've taken people through, whether they're students, executives, what have you? You take them through some of those kinds of experiences. How are they different when they leave?
Well, I think for me, the most graphic illustration is our experience with the officers of the U.S. Marine Corps who put about 200 of our MBA students and executive MBA students through a day and a half of a kind of a combat course at Quantico, Virginia. I've gone through that myself. I've been there a number of times to witness it as well. And what I've always noticed in myself and witnessing others is that as what they call fire teams, groups of five, in our case students, with a few faculty like myself sometimes included, are put into circumstances where they have to make an extremely difficult set of decisions to solve a seemingly unsolvable problem. To make that more graphic where we're sitting, Tracy, if you were my instructor, my Marine Corps officer, you might say, Mike, you and your team have 8 minutes to pick up the large table in this radio studio. You've got to move it onto the street, and you can't touch the floor. You look around. No way. Can't be done. It can be done. And through the exercise of extremely effective leadership, which means making good decisions, fast decisions, drawing the entire team together to contribute to those decisions, there is a solution that can be achieved. I have noticed when a fire team, one of our groups, goes through that kind of exercise the first time, myself included, we were pretty terrible. And the Marine Corps instructor pointed that out. We were terrible. I teach the topic of leadership, and he said something, I knew it, that's why you were so terrible, or something like that. With that feedback, though, we coached ourselves, and he did too, on how to do it better 15 minutes later. And we were dramatically better.
Wow.
And by the end of the day, we had formed as a team. We were a kind of a strike force. We could get in there, quickly look, compile our thinking, make good and timely decisions to get this table from here onto the street.
Wow. So you saw a real transformation in a matter of hours, it sounds
we
like.
We did.
Let's talk about some of the headlines, Mike, recently. Certainly Penn State jumps to mind when we think about some of the leadership issues that took place there that led to what we've been seeing of late, the sanctions, the free report, and so on. Unpack that for us a little bit, if you would, and where some of the leadership missteps were and what could have perhaps prevented what we've been seeing in the last weeks and months?
Well, the free report, for starters, is an extremely hard-hitting and almost a model of a document. So Louis Freeh and his team interviewed just about everybody in and around the events at Penn State. As we all know, they wrote an extremely hard-hitting, very detailed report on the malfeasance that led to this disastrous circumstance. Penn State now severely punished by the NCAA as well, in large part because of what the free report does describe happened there. I would pick out two elements that really are a couple chapters in the free report. The first references the culture at Penn State, which had formed in a way that protected those in powerful positions and was very resistant to evidence coming up from below, most famously by a couple janitors who witnessed and reported what they saw and were rebuffed in that process. I've got to quote a problem here with the culture. Where does culture begin? It always begins at the top. The tone is set by, in this case, the president of the university, and the culture that had evolved, partly inadvertently, culture's there, but the president failed to ensure there was a good, a culture that encouraged upward flow of negative information. We have problem number one there. Second problem, though, I would single out, and there's a lot in this for what people worry about now around mismanagement, risk management, and that is that the Board of Trustees, strong board, if you look at the backgrounds of people who served on the board, were, by the free assessment, my words here, kind of asleep at the switch. They knew they weren't getting good information about what was happening at the university. They sometimes asked for it, didn't get it, didn't follow up. But isn't that the role of a governing board, in effect, to not only govern but help lead? And here, thus, to pick up on one free conclusion, is the problem of those who oversee those who lead day to day. And in this case, the failure of the Board of Trustees of Penn State to take on this problem that most organizations left to their own devices can inadvertently take on risky commitments, risky circumstances. In this case, an enormous risk was brewing in the ranks in the athletic department, but undetected or unreported to the top, this was a risk that should have been seen in the same sense that we retrospectively could have better seen 9/11 coming, could have seen Katrina coming, could have seen the problems with the Fukushima plant in Japan coming. And thus, just to get back and sum it up, we've got a cultural failure that begins at the top. We've got a governance failure that is at the top.
So thinking about that then, what are some of the items perhaps on the leader's checklist that maybe were omitted that could have helped to prevent some of the things that we've seen at Penn State?
You know, for me, looking at the events at Penn State and many of these other organizations that have hit an enormous problem of their own making, I think second item I have on this leader's checklist here, which is at all times in a leadership position, you really do have to think and act strategically. Think and act strategically. What that implies, just to unpack that a little bit, is that in a position of responsibility, you can't just focus on the room you're in or the people that you're seeing. You've got to think about the other players. You've got to think about what could go wrong. You have to think about what you're doing now, how that's going to be perceived later on, especially in this particular case, if something is very wrong, will the failure to detect and solve something that's gone egregiously wrong in effect, acquire an exponentially rising penalty if not acted on now.
Yeah.
But this is strategic thinking 101. And my own assessment of what happened in Japan in the wake of that terrible earthquake of now a year and a half ago, 2 years ago, what happened in the Gulf with BP, what happened in the case of the many years of festering problems at Penn State, came in part to the lack of a willingness to think and act strategically.
Yeah. I heard one leadership expert say, you know, what's the story you want to tell 5 or 10 years from now, and act according to what you want to be able to say 10 years down the line?
A good phrase along that line, this is how I reinforce the point with myself and certainly in the classroom, bring the future into the present. So in 5 years, if the trustees are going to be shocked if they hear about this malfeasance in the locker rooms at Penn State, would they wish they have heard that 5 years earlier? Yeah. To say the obvious, yes.
Yeah. Let's see if we can quickly squeeze in a call, and we'll go from there. We'll start off in Marlton with Mike. Hi, Mike. Welcome to Radio Times.
Hi, good morning. I have a quick question for the professor. He mentioned that he taught a course in leadership, and it occurred to me, our son, ever since he was in middle school, he knew he wanted to go to West Point. And he did. He graduated in 2004. He is a combat infantry ranger, airborne air assault, and for the past 2 years, he's been a Green Beret team leader. He went through some of the worst battles in the past several years in Afghanistan. And I'm wondering, what would the professor teach my son as far as leadership? My son has taught leadership courses, and he's already proven himself to be quite a leader under some of the worst conditions imaginable. So I'm wondering how the professor would perhaps adjust the course to teach leadership skills to someone with such proven leadership skills already.
Mike, before we answer that, let me just say quickly, we've only got about 60 seconds before we take a break, so we may have to continue that answer on the other side of the break. Just wanted to warn you. Go ahead, Mike.
The very short answer is I would love to learn from him. Leadership is an ongoing dialogue, and we often learn as much by talking with other people back and forth as anything else. Number two, while we go to a break, thank you for your son's national service.
Yes, indeed. Lots to say about that, and many more questions, too. We want to talk about the importance of integrity and sort of, from what I can see, Mike, a renewed emphasis on that in the private sector, the integrity officers now that are being hired, that sort of thing. A lot of talk about compliance that we perhaps hadn't heard so much before. So much more to talk about. We'd love your questions and your comments as we talk about leadership and how to do it well and what happens when it's not done so well. The number to join in the conversation is 888-477-9499. You are listening to Radio Times on WHYY.
The Violette DeMazia Foundation supports WHYY. Are you an art lover? The DeMazia Foundation teaches ways to appreciate works of art wherever you may encounter them. Classes and tours appropriate for anyone interested in seeing their world like an artist are forming at locations including the Barnes Foundation, Chester County Historical Society, and the Wallingford Community Arts Center. Registration is online at www.demazia.org.
On the next Fresh Air, Bishop Leonard Blair. He helped conduct the doctrinal assessment of the Leadership Conference of Women Religious, an organization representing 80% of U.S. nuns. Now he's assigned to help make sure the group conforms to the Church's teachings on human sexuality, the right to life, the ordination of women, and other issues. Join us
this afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
We'll be right back. I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. The British government has accepted the claims of Kenyans who said they were tortured at the end of colonial rule. So what happens now? Also, veteran Olympics reporter John Powers looks back at his most memorable Olympics. It's not that far back. Beijing, 2008. That's Public Radio's Daily Digest of news and culture here and now.
Today at noon on WHYY.
And you are listening to Radio Times on WHYY. I'm Tracy Matisak, filling in for Marty Musk-Cohen, and we're talking about leadership and what happens when it is not done well. There have been lots of headlines with examples of that of late, and also some headlines with examples of what happens when it is, in fact, done well. For some help with that topic, we are talking with the author of The Leader's Checklist, Michael Useem, who is management professor at the Wharton School of Business at Pennsylvania, at University of Pennsylvania. And Mike, when we left off, you were answering a question from our caller, Mike in Marlton, who was talking about his son in the military.
Well, to pick up on one particular reference that he made to the U.S. Military Academy at West Point, that academy, the U.S. Naval Academy at Annapolis, U.S. Air Force Academy, Colorado Springs, Colorado, the Marine Training Base for Officers, Quantico, Virginia, have really been at this task of developing leadership for over 200 years. We work with all of the above except for the Air Force Academy, and a lot of what we do now really comes from what we've learned by working with West Point, with Annapolis, and with the Marine Corps. And at the center of all three of those programs, same is true at the Air Force Academy as well, is an emphasis on leadership, and the number one element there is character. So courage, valor, commitment, integrity. Yeah. And by the conclusions of some research studies, when it comes to why anybody would want to follow anybody else, ask it from the follower's standpoint, a third, a half of that decision is based not on the vision, not on the strategy that somebody is proposing, but on who that leader is as a person. The person's character.
Yeah.
Are they a person of transparency, of integrity, of commitment? Do they put mission over self-interest?
Yeah.
And for that reason, communicating your character, I did identify as one of the most vital elements for your checklist. Take time wherever you are to just say a few words about you, the person.
Yeah. And how would a leader do that, Mike, in practical terms? If you want to communicate your character, certainly you don't want to do that in an egotistical kind of way. But what's a good way for a leader to communicate that in such a way that those who are hearing the message can say, okay, this is a person of integrity. This is a person of honor.
Maybe a way to see it initially is to ask about how not to do it. And with a little time, say with scant time, I might be tempted as a leader to abbreviate it this way. I'm a great leader. You can always trust me. My teenage children respect me.
That's saying something right there.
That's quite a strong statement there.
Because I have teenagers.
And finally, I'm not a crook. And by the time we even get to the phrase, trust me, most people begin to duck for cover, as they should. So the way character is communicated, there's a fine art to this. We make this a very important part of our own curriculum. It has to come more indirectly. It's, in the most simple terms, the way you treat people when you walk by them. In more complex ways, though, it is the story that you offer about yourself. And just to illustrate that very briefly, a couple years ago, I was in a very large gathering hall with Chancellor of Germany, Angela Merkel, much in the news since she's at the center of the Euro crisis at the moment. At that time, though, she was talking about the future of Germany, and then she broke off her script from her prepared comments, and she said, by the way, I come from the German city of Leipzig. And I'm thinking to myself, what's that got to do with her prescription for revitalizing German industry? But she then said, you will recall that Leipzig was part of East Germany through 1989, and I lived in a world where there was no free movement of labor. There was no protection of intellectual property. There wasn't a whole lot of innovation. And thus, I've seen the opposite. So you know when I commit to more free movement of labor and so on, I have a personal history here that is going to stand with those principles. That was 30 seconds out of a 30-minute speech. Going back to the research, that was about half of her delivery in convincing people out there in the audience to listen to her and maybe to follow with her.
Yeah, she gave them a good reason. Which leads to an interesting question, particularly for you as a professor at Wharton. Can character, which then leads to integrity, ethics, so forth, can it be taught?
Yes, if we go back to Abraham Lincoln's famous phrase, the challenge during the U.S. Civil War at that time was to, direct quote, to appeal to the better angels of our nature. There are other forces out there. The darker side of the human mind has occasionally led in completely disastrous outcomes. The challenge of leadership, having put it that way, is to make certain we go for what's the best in people and draw upon, in that sense, the better angels of our nature. How do we do that? To think about this very, call it tactically, many organizations have a statement of value, a statement of integrity. One of the best known in the industry in business is the famous 303-word credo of Johnson & Johnson. It says, it's carved in limestone at the headquarters of J&J up in New Brunswick. It says, our purpose as a company is to serve people who need our products. Second paragraph, the community, employees, and then shareholders. Now, that's a statement. A statement is only as good as it's understood, conveyed, and reenacted. And watching more closely one of the great remakes in recent, or not so recent now, American business history, when Tyco, that back in 02 employed 240,000 people, nearly went bankrupt because of malfeasance of people at the top. The new management that came in for the next year spent an enormous amount of time preparing a statement of integrity, which was very good, but then above all, meeting just about everybody in the company, saying, this is who we are, this is what we stand for, we've got a zero-tolerance policy on it. So, quick major point, though, to come back to where we are, having, coming from the top, a statement and its reinforcement of what we want to be on the brighter side of the angels of our nature is vital for ensuring we've got integrity when we need it.
Yeah. Well, speaking of the folks at the top, let's go to the phones to LaSalle, and we'll welcome David to our conversation. Hi, David.
Thank you for taking my call. I'm interested to know where you see our current focus on leadership as contributing to the rising inequality in our country. I mean, you've used the military oftentimes, and there is a certain clear hierarchy. And I think within our culture, we've moved towards that somewhat. And I think it's contributing to the wide increase in inequality of incomes and wealth. So any comment you have would be appreciated, and I'll take this off the air. Thank you.
It's a great question because it really goes to the heart of what national leadership ought to be defined around. If we have a development, a problem, a rising inequality, environmental contamination, the danger of climate change, and well beyond, aren't these the province of national leadership? Now, inequality by many of my academic economist friends, the rising inequality that we see in wages, for example, in the U.S., in the last 20 years, the wage structure has become more extreme. The difference between a CEO's pay at a big company and a frontline worker has expanded out to something like 340-1. These broader statistics and tendencies are really a product of economic forces over which we have no immediate direct control. This is the way, for a lot of reasons, with outsourcing, with new technologies, we've had a growing level, a product of all that is we've had a growing degree of inequality. Exactly back to your point, if this inequality is creating a new set of problems, poverty is extreme. We have people who need assistance if the extremes in income and wealth are leading to kind of a breaking up of our sense of community and country. Having said that, having identified these outcomes of this underlying economic problem, isn't this the calling of national political leadership at the moment? And I think it is.
Yeah. Several other things we want to try to squeeze in, Mike, before we wrap up the program. But do you see in your travels and in the work that you do, is there a greater need for organizations to have an integrity officer within, a compliance officer, someone who is really keeping an eye on these things? It seems like there's been more talk about that lately.
Well, certainly many companies, I agree, many companies have been moving in this direction. Many organizations, not just companies, have been moving in the direction of a compliance officer, an integrity officer. I would see each of those as part of a broader effort to ensure that the organizations, my university, a company like Johnson & Johnson, has the best possible leadership from the front lines all the way up to the top corner office holder. And at the center of anybody's leadership, whatever the level, is, of course, character, of which integrity, central item there. Many companies, many public organizations now, over the last 20 years, following General Electric's lead of going back 50 years now, have begun to put explicit leadership development programs into place. And every program I've worked with, I've witnessed many at companies ranging from Johnson & Johnson out to Google in California, the emphasis on leadership development always includes a focus on integrity. And an integrity officer, in that sense, ought to be the tip of the iceberg. You also need what's below the surface for their job to be done the right way.
Yeah. Speaking of integrity, we have to talk about Stephen Covey for just a moment. Passed away just a week or two ago. What's his legacy, in your view?
Well, his legacy is enormous in that his books collectively have sold more than 20 million copies. And Seven Habits is the most famous, but he has another half dozen books in print. Passed away not so long ago. Actually spent an hour with him a couple of years ago, and in hearing him talk about what he's doing and looking at Seven Habits in particular, the ideas there are really great. For example, just to pick out one, and this is one of the checklist items in the leader's checklist, if you're anybody, he speaks to everybody, not just those in leadership positions, but what he says, obviously vital for thinking about leadership. One of his principles is don't sit around. Be proactive. Yeah. You see something, do something. Yeah. And in that regard, I do include in this assessment I make the notion of getting into the game. Even if you're not in charge, if you see something that you ought to fix or are best positioned to notice and do something about, that's not for the CEO or the president necessarily only to be concerned with.
Yeah.
That's you.
I want to talk in our last couple of minutes about leadership done well. One of the examples that you use in your book is the Prime Minister in Chile when there was the mine collapse, and how leadership in that case was done quite well. And in a nutshell, what was done right in that situation?
The person who led the rescue of the miners, this is back August through October 2010, my guess is at least half the listeners, Tracy, today, did see at least one of the miners come up live on CNN television. There was more than a billion people did witness on October 12 and 13, at least one of those 33 miners come to the surface. The person who made that possible, along with the president of Chile, Sebastian Piñera, was the Minister of Mines, Lawrence Goldborn, age 55. He could be us. We could be him. He had a background not in mining, but in retail. And when the minister, when the president of Chile swore to uphold the Constitution of Chile back in March 2010, at his side was Lawrence Goldborn, now becoming the Minister of Mines, sworn to uphold the oath of office to do the right thing by mining regulation in Chile. He didn't own the mine that had the problem. wasn't there when the cave-in occurred, but he almost instinctually, he did talk to his boss, the president, good to lead up and not just downwardly, before he went to the Atacama in northern Chile where the mine was located. But as Lawrence Goldborn arrived, he quickly appreciated two negative factors. Number one, the small mining company where the disaster occurred did not have the resources and maybe even the talent to effect the rescue. Number two, the miners, 2,000 feet below the surface, are in a mine now, according to a rescue crew, that threatens to cave in completely so that rescuers can't even go into the front entry of the mining shaft to try to reach the now lost 33 miners. Lawrence Goldborn, with that extremely bleak assessment, said, we're going to make a difference here. And over the next 2 months, he built a team, stayed strong, strongly focused on the mission, which was getting these 33 guys out. There were 33 mm-hmm. families around, of course. And on October 13th, the last of the 33 miners did reach the surface. Sebastian Piñera, the president, was there and said to the last, the supervisor of the shift, the last miner to come out, you've done your duty in helping to keep these people alive below the surface. And Lawrence Goldborn on the surface, he made the difference as well.
Leadership done well. We have been talking with the author of The Leader's Checklist, Michael Useem. He is professor of management at the University of Pennsylvania's Wharton School. Thank you so much for stopping by to share your leadership expertise with us and help us with some guiding principles to make good decisions.
Tracy, great to talk with you and our callers.
You are listening to Radio Times on WHYY. I'm Tracy Matisak, filling in for Marty Moscoane. Next hour.